When he took it far into his lungs, it seemed to unwind his cares and dreads, setting everything but itself behind him and lifting him into a state of calm suspense. He relaxed in the gentle breeze, settled himself more comfortably against the tree. Atiyaran's shoulder touched his with warmth, as if she had forgiven him. The night deepened, and the stars gleamed expectantly, and the breeze sifted the cobwebs and dust from Covenant's heart. And waiting was not difficult. The first flickering light came like a twist of resolution which brought the whole night into focus. Across the width of the bowl, he saw a flame like the burn of a candle, tiny in the distance and yet vivid, swaying yellow and orange as clearly as if he held the candlestick in his hands. He felt strangely sure that the distance was meaningless. If the flame were before him on the grass, it would be no larger than his palm. As the wraith appeared, Atiyaran's breath hissed intently between her teeth, and Covenant sat up straighter to concentrate more keenly. With a lucid, cycling movement, the flame moved down into the bowl. It was not halfway to the bottom when a second fire arrived on the northern rim. Then two more wraiths entered from the south, and then, too suddenly to be counted, a host of flames began tracing their private ways into the bowl from all directions. Some passed within 10 feet of Atiyaran and Covenant on either side, but they seemed unconscious of the observers. They followed their slow cycles as if each were alone in the hills, independent of every gleam but its own. Yet their lights poured together, casting a dome of gold through which the stars could barely be seen. And at moments, particular wraiths seemed to bow and revolve around each other, as if sharing a welcome on their way toward the center. Covenant watched the great movement that brought thousands of the flames, bobbing at shoulder height into the bowl, and he hardly dared to breathe. In the excess of his wonder, he felt like an unpermitted spectator beholding some occult enactment which was not meant for human eyes. He clutched his chest as if his chance to see the celebration to its end rode on the utter silence of his respiration, as if he feared that any sound might violate the fiery conclave, scare the wraiths away. Then a change came over the gathered flames. Up into the sky rose a high, scintillating, wordless song, an arching melody. From the center of the bowl, the private rotations of the wraiths resolved themselves into a radiating, circling dance. Each wraith seemed finally to have found its place in a large, wheel-like pattern which filled half the bowl, and the wheel began to turn on its center. But there were no lights in the center. The wheel turned on a hub of stark blackness which refused the glow of the wraiths. As the song spread through the night, the great circle revolved, each flame dancing a secret independent dance, various in moves and sways, each flame keeping its place in the whole pattern as it turned. And in the space between the inner hub and the outer rim, more circles rolled, so that the whole wheel was filled with many wheels, all turning. And no wraith kept one position long. The flames flowed continuously through their moving pattern, so that as the wheel turned, the individual wraiths danced from place to place, now swinging along the outer rim, now gyring through the middle circles, now circling the hub. Every wraith moved and changed places constantly, but the pattern was never broken. No hiatus of misstep gapped the wheel, even for an instant, and every flame seemed both perfectly alone, wandering mysteriously after some personal destiny through the dance, and perfectly a part of the whole. While they danced, their light grew stronger until the stars were paled out of the sky and the night was withdrawn like a distant spectator of the celebration. And the beauty and wonder of the dance made of Covenant's suspense a yearning ache. Then a new change entered the festival. Covenant did not realize it until Atiyaran touched his arm. Her signal sent a thrill of awareness through him, and he saw that the wheel of the wraiths was slowly bending. The rest of the wheel retained its shape, and the black core did not move. Gradually, the turning circle became lopsided as the outer wraiths moved closer to the onlookers. Soon, the growing bulge pointed unmistakably at Covenant. In response, he seemed to feel their song more intensely, a keening, ecstatic lament, a threnody as throbbingly passionate as a dirge and as dispassionate as a sublime, impersonal affirmation. Their nearing flames filled him with awe and fascination, so that he shrank within himself but could not move. Cycle after cycle, the wraiths reached out toward him, and he clasped his hands over his knees and held himself still, taut-hearted and utterless before the fiery dancers. In moments, the tip of this long extension from the circle stood above him, and he could see each flame bowing to him as it danced by. Then the rim of the extension dipped, and the pace of the dance slowed, as though to give each wraith a chance to linger in his company. Soon the fires were passing within reach of his hand. Then the long arm of the dance flared, as if a decision had run through the dancers. The nearest wraith moved forward to settle on his wedding band. He flinched, expecting the fire to burn him, but there was no pain. The flame attached itself to the ring as to a wick, and he felt faintly the harmonies of the celebration song through his finger. As the wraith held to his ring, it danced and jumped as if it were feeding excitedly there, and slowly its color turned from flaming yellow-orange to silver-white. When the transformation was complete, that wraith flashed away and the next took its place. A succession of fires followed, each dancing on his ring until it became argent. And as his anxiety relaxed, the succession grew faster. In a short time, the line of glistening white wraiths had almost reached back to the rest of the dance. Each new flame presented itself swiftly, as if eager for some apotheosis, some culmination of its being in the white gold of Covenant's ring. Before long, his emotion became too strong to let him remain seated. He surged to his feet, holding out his ring so that the wraiths could light on it without lowering themselves. Atiyaran stood beside him. He had eyes only for the transformation which his ring somehow made possible, but she looked away across the dance. What she saw made her dig her fingers like claws of despair into his arm. "No. By the Seven, this must not be." Her cry snatched at his attention. His gaze jumped across the bowl. "There, that is the meaning of the ill your feet have felt." What he saw staggered him like a blow to the heart. Coming over the northeast rim of the bowl into the golden light was an intruding wedge of blackness, as pitch dark and unilluminable as the spawning ground of night. The wedge cut its narrow way down toward the dance, and through the song of the flames, it carried a sound like a host of bloody feet rushing over clean grass. Deliberately, agonizingly, it reached inward without breaking its formation. In moments, the tip of the darkness sliced into the dance and began plunging toward its center. In horror, Covenant saw that the dance did not halt or pause. At the wedge's first touch, the song of the wraiths dropped from the air as if it had been ripped away by sacrilege, leaving no sound behind it but a noise like running murder. But the dance did not stop. The flames went on revolving as if they were unconscious of what was happening to them, helpless. They followed their cycles into the wedge's path and vanished as if they had fallen into an abyss. No wraith emerged from that darkness. Swallowing every light that touched it, the black wedge gouged its way into the celebration.
"They will all die,"
Atyarin groaned. They cannot stop, cannot escape. They must dance until the dance is done. All dead. Every wraith, every bright light of the land. This must not be. Help them. Covenant, help them. But Covenant did not know how to help. He was paralyzed. The sight of the black wedge made him feel as nauseated as if he were observing across a gulf of numbness his fingers being eaten by a madman. Nauseated and enraged and impotent, as if he had waited too long to defend himself and now had no hands with which to fight back. The knife of Triarch slipped from his numb fingers and disappeared in darkness. How? For an instant, Atyarin dragged furiously at him. Covenant, help them, she shrieked into his face. Then she turned and raced down into the valley to meet the wedge. The wraiths. Her movement broke the freeze of his horror. Snatching up the staff of Baradakas, he ducked under the flames and sped after her, holding himself bent over to stay below the path of the wraiths. A madness seemed to hasten his feet. He caught Atyarin before she was halfway to the hub. Thrusting her behind him, he dashed on toward the penetrating wedge, spurred by a blind conviction that he had to reach the center before the blackness did. Atyarin followed, shouting after him, Ware and ward! They are Urviles! Demon-dim corruption! He scarcely heard her. He was focused on the furious need to gain the center of the dance. For better speed, he ran more upright, flicking his head aside whenever a wraith flashed near the level of his eyes. With a last burst, he broke into the empty core of the wheel. He halted. Now he was close enough to see that the wedge was composed of tall, crowded figures, so black-fleshed that no light could gleam or glisten on their skin. As the helpless wraiths swung into the wedge, the attackers ate them. The Urviles drew nearer. The tip of their wedge was a single figure, larger than the rest. Covenant could see it clearly. It looked like one of the Wayanhim grown tall and evil. Long torso, short limbs of equal length, pointed ears high on its head, eyeless face almost filled by gaping nostrils. Its slit mouth snapped like a trap whenever a wraith came near. Mucus trailed from its nostrils back along either side of its head. When Covenant faced it, its nose twitched as if it smelled new game, and it snarled out a cadenced bark like an exhortation to the other creatures. The whole wedge thrust eagerly forward. Atyarin caught up with Covenant and shouted in his ear, Your hand! Look at your hand! He jerked up his left hand. A wraith still clung to his ring, burning whitely, obliviously dancing. The next instant, the leading Urvile breached the core of the dance and stopped. The attackers stood packed against each other's shoulders behind their leader. Dark, roynish, and cruel, they slavered together and bit at the helpless wraiths. Covenant quailed as if his heart had turned to sand. But Atyarin raged, Now! Strike them now! Trembling, he stepped forward. He had no idea what to do. At once, the first Urvile brandished a long knife with a seething blood-red blade. Fell power radiated from the blade. In spite of themselves, Covenant and Atyarin recoiled. The Urvile raised its hand to strike. Impulsively, Covenant shoved the white, burning wraith at the Urvile's face. With a snarl of pain, the creature jumped back. A sudden intuition gripped Covenant. Instantly, he touched the end of his staff to the burning wraith. With a flash, bold white flame bloomed from the staff, shading the gold of the dance and challenging the force of the Urviles. Their leader retreated again. But at once it regained its determination. Springing forward, it stabbed into the heart of the white fire with its blood-red blade. Power clashed in the core of the dance. The Urviles' blades seethed like hot hate, and the staff blazed wildly. Their conflict threw sparks as if the air were aflame in blood and lightning. But the Urvile was a master. Its might filled the bowl with a deep crumbling sound, like the crushing of a boulder under huge pressure. In one abrupt exertion, Covenant's fire was stamped out. The force of the extinguishing threw him and Atiyanan to their backs on the grass. With a growl of triumph, the Urviles poised to leap for the kill. Covenant saw the red knife coming and cowered with a pall of death over his mind. But Atiyanan scrambled back to her feet, crying, "Melancurian! Melancurian Abasa!" Her voice sounded frail against the victory of the Urviles, but she met them squarely, grappled with the leader's knife hand. Momentarily, she withheld its stroke. Then, from behind her to the west, her cry was answered. An iron voice full of fury shouted, "Melancurian Abatha! Minus mil banas nimaram kabal! Melancurian Abatha! Abatha nimaram!" The sound broke through Covenant's panic, and he lurched up to Atiyaran's aid. But together they could not hold back the Urvile. It flung them to the ground again. At once, it pounced at them. It was stopped halfway by a hulking form that leaped over them to tackle it. For a moment, the two wrestled savagely. Then the newcomer took the blood-red blade and drove it into the heart of the creature. A burst of snarls broke from the Urviles. Covenant heard a sweeping noise like the sound of many children running. Looking up, he saw a stream of small animals pour into the bowl. Rabbits, badgers, weasels, moles, foxes, a few dogs. With silent determination, they hurled themselves at the Urviles. The wraiths were scattering. While Covenant and Atiyaran stumbled to their feet, the last flame passed from the bowl. But the Urviles remained, and their size made the animals' attack look like a mere annoyance. In the sudden darkness, the creatures seemed to expand, as if the light had hindered them, forced them to keep their close ranks. Now they broke away from each other. Dozens of blades that boiled like lava leaped out as one, and in horrible unison began to slaughter the animals. Before Covenant could take in all that was happening, the hulking figure who had saved them turned and hissed, "Go north to the river. I have released the wraiths. Now we will make time for your escape. Go!" "No," Atiyaran panted. "You are the only man. The animals are not enough. We must help you fight." "Together we are not enough," he cried. "Do you forget your task? You must reach the lords. Must. Drool must pay for this desecration. Go. I cannot give you much time." Shouting, "Melancurian Abatha!" he whirled and jumped into the thick of the fray, felling Urviles with his mighty fists. Pausing only to pick up the staff of Baradakis, Atiyaran fled northward, and Covenant followed her, running as if the Urvile blades were striking at his back. The stars gave them enough light. They drove themselves up the slope, not looking to see if they were pursued, not caring about the packs they left behind, afraid to think of anything except their need for distance. As they passed over the rim of the bowl, the sounds of slaughter were abruptly dimmed. They heard no pursuit, but they ran on, ran and still ran, and did not stop until they were caught in mid-stride by a short scream, full of agony and failed strength. At the sound, Atiyaran fell to her knees and dropped her forehead to the earth, weeping openly.
"He is dead," she wailed. "The unfettered one, dead. Alas for the land. All my paths are ill, and destruction fills all my choices. From the first I have brought wrong upon us. Now there will be no more celebrations, and the blame is mine."
Raising her face to Covenant, she sobbed,
"Take your staff and strike me, unbeliever."
Blankly, Covenant stared into the pooled hurt of her eyes. He felt benumbed with pain and grief and wasted rage, and did not understand why she castigated herself. He stooped for the staff, then took her arm and lifted her to her feet. Stunned and empty, he led her onward into the night until she had cried out her anguish and could stand on her own again. He wanted to weep himself, but in his long struggle with the misery of being a leper, he had forgotten how, and now he could only keep on walking. He was aware, as Atiyaran regained control of herself and pulled away from him, that she accused him of something. Throughout the sleepless night of their northward trek, he could do nothing about it. Chapter 11. The Unhomed. Gradually, night stumbled, as if stunned and wandering aimlessly into an overcast day, limped through the wilderland of transition as though there were no knowing where the waste of darkness ended and the ashes of light began. The low clouds seemed full of grief, tense and uneasy with accumulated woe, and yet affectless, unable to rain, as if the air clenched itself too hard for tears. And through the dawn, Atiyaran and Covenant moved heavily, unevenly, like pieces of a broken lament. The coming of one day made no difference to them, did not alter the way they fled, terrorless because their capacity for fear was exhausted, into the north. Day and night were nothing but disguises, motley raiment for the constant shadow on the land's heart. To that heart they could not guess how much damage had been done. They could only judge by their own hurt. And so throughout the long, dismal night and day which followed the defilement of the celebration, they walked on, haunted by what they had witnessed, and numb to everything else, as though even hunger and thirst and fatigue were extinguished in them. That night, their flesh reached the end of its endurance, and they pitched blindly into sleep, no longer able to care what pursuit was on their trail. While they slept, the sky found some release for its tension. Blue lightning flailed the hills. Thunder groaned in long-suppressed pain. When the travelers awoke, the sun stood over them, and their clothes were drenched with the night's rain. But sunshine and morning could not unscar their wounded memories. They clambered like corpses to their feet, ate Aliantha, drank from a stream, set off again walking as if they were stiff with death. Yet time and Aliantha and Andalanian air slowly worked their resuscitations. Slowly, Covenant's weary thoughts shifted. The trudging horror of slaughter receded, allowed a more familiar pain to ache in him. He could hear Atiyaran crying, "Covenant, help them," and the sound made his blood run cold with impotence. The wraiths," he moaned dimly, distantly to himself. They had been so beautiful, and he had been so unable to save them. Yet Atiyaran had believed him capable of saving them. She had expected some putting forth of power. Like Lena and Baradakas and everyone else he met, she saw him as Beric Halfhand reborn, the master of wild magic. "You have might," the despiser had said. "You will never know what it is." He did not know. How could he? What did magic or even dreams have to do with him? And yet the wraiths had paid homage to his ring as if they recognized his lost humanity. They had been changed by it. After a time, he said, without meaning to speak aloud, "I would have saved them if I could." "You have the power." Atiyaran's voice was dull, inert, as if she were no longer capable of grief or anger. "What power?" he asked painfully. "Do you wear the white gold for nothing?" "It's just a ring. I wear it because I'm a leper. I don't know anything about power." She did not look at him.
I cannot see. You are closed to me.
At that, he wanted to protest, cry out, grab her by the shoulders, and shout into her face, "Closed! Look! Look at me! I'm no Beric, no hero. I'm too sick for that." But he lacked the strength, and he had been too badly hurt. Hurt as much by Atiyaran's impossible demand as by his powerlessness.
How? The wraiths. How can this happen to me?
A moment passed while he groaned over the question. Then he sighed to himself.
I should have known.
He should have heard his danger in Atiyaran's singing of the Beric legend, seen it in Andalin, felt it in the revulsion in his boots. But he had been deaf, blind, numb. He had been so busy moving ahead, putting madness behind him, that he had ignored the madness toward which the path of his dream tended. This dream wanted him to be a hero, a savior. Therefore it seduced him, swept him along, urging him forward so that he would run heedless of himself to risk his life for the sake of wraiths, the land, illusion. The only difference in this between Atiyaran and Lord Fowl was that the despiser wanted him to fail.
You will never know what it is.
Of course he would never know. A visceral anger writhed under his fatigue. He was dreaming. That was the answer to everything, to the land's impossible expectations of him as well as to the land's impossibility. He knew the difference between reality and dream. He was sane. He was a leper. And yet the wraiths had been so beautiful. They had been slaughtered.
I'm a leper.
Trembling, he began to give himself a VSE. Hellfire! What do wraiths and wild magic and Beric bloody half-hand have to do with me? His body appeared whole. He could see no injuries. His clothing was rumpled but unrent. But the end of the higher brand's staff had been blackened by the power of the Urviles.
By hell, they can't do this to me.
Fuming against his weariness, he shambled along at Atiyaran's side. She did not look at him, did not seem to recognize his presence at all. And during that day he left her alone as if he feared how he would respond if he gave her an opportunity to accuse him. But when they halted that evening, the cold night and the brittle stars made him regret the loss of their blankets and graveling. To distract himself from his hollow discomfort, he resumed his half-forgotten efforts to learn about the land. Stiffly, he said,
"Tell me about that whoever saved us. Back there."
A long silence passed before she said,
"Tomorrow."
Her voice was lightless, unillumined by anything except torpor or defeat.
"Let me be. Until tomorrow."
Covenant nodded in the darkness. It felt thick with cold and beating wings, but he could answer it better than he could reply to Atiyaran's tone. For a long time he shivered as if he were prepared to resent every dream that afflicted a miserable mankind, and at last he fell into fitful slumber. The next day, the 9th from Soaring Woodhelven, Atiyaran told Covenant about the Unfettered One in a voice as flat as crushed rock, as if she had reached the point where what she said, how she exposed herself, no longer mattered to her.
"There are those from the Lore's Rot," she said, "who find that they cannot work for the land or the lore of the old lords in the company of their fellows. Lords or lore wardens, the followers of sword or staff. Those have some private vision which compels them to seek it in isolation. But their need for aloneness does not divide them from the people. They are given the rights of unfettering and freed from all common demands to quest after their own lore with the blessing of the lords and the respect of all who love the land. For the lords learned long ago that the desire for aloneness need not be a selfish desire if it is not made so by those who do not feel it. Many of the unfettered have never returned into knowledge, but stories have grown up around those ones who have not vanished utterly. Some are said to know the secrets of dreams, others to practice deep mysteries in the arts of healing, still others to be the friends of the animals, speaking their language and calling on their help in times of great need. Such a one saved us.
Her voice thickened momentarily.
A learner of the wraiths and a friend to the small beasts of the woods. He knew more of the seven words than my ears have ever heard.
She groaned softly.
A mighty man to have been so slain. He released the wraiths and saved our lives. Would that I were worth so much. By the seven. No evil has ever before been aimed at the wraiths of Andalane. The Greyslayer himself never dared, and it is said that the ritual of desecration itself had no power to touch them. Now it is in my heart that they will not dance again.
After a heavy pause, she went on,
No matter. All things end in perversion and death. Sorrow belongs to those who also hope. But that unfettered one gave his life so that you and your message and your ring might reach the lords. This we will accomplish so that such sacrifices may have meaning.
She fell silent again for a moment, and Covenant asked himself, Is that why? Is that what living is for? To vindicate the deaths of others? But he said nothing, and shortly Atiyaran's thoughts limped back to her subject.
But the unfettered. Some are dreamers, some healers, some share the life of the animals. Some delve the earth to uncover the secrets of the cave whites. Others learn the lore of the demondim. Whatever knowledge guides the one's private prophecy. I have even heard it whispered that some unfettered follow the legend of Coroyal Wildwood of Garrotting Deep and become forestals. But that is a perilous thought, even when whispered. Never before have I seen one of the unfettered, but I have heard the rites of unfettering. A hymn is sung.
Dully she recited,
Free, unfettered, shriven, free. Dream that what is dreamed will be. Hold eyes clasped shut until they see, and sing the silent prophecy, and be unfettered, shriven, free. There is more. But my weakness will not recall. It may be that I will not sing any song again.
She pulled her robe tight around her shoulders as if a wind were chilling through her and said nothing more for the rest of the day. That night, when they had camped, Covenant again could not sleep. Unwillingly, he lay awake and watched for the sliver of the new moon. When it finally rose over the hills, he was appalled to see that it was no longer silver white, but red, the color of blood and Drool's Laval eyes. It hued the hills with wrongness, gave the night a tinge of crimson like blood sweat, sheening the shrubs and trees and grass and slopes, as if the whole of Andalane were in torment. Under it, the violated ground shimmered as if it were shuddering. Covenant stared at it, could not close his eyes. Though he badly wanted company, he clamped his teeth together, refused to awaken Atiyaran. Alone and shivering, with the staff of Baradakas clutched in his sweating hands, he sat up until moonset, then slept on the edge of consternation until dawn. And on the fourth day after the night of the dance, it was he who set the pace of their traveling. He pushed their speed more and more as the day passed, as though he feared that the bloody moon were gaining on them. When they halted for the night, he gave Atiyaran his staff and made her sit awake to see the moon. It came over the horizon in a crimson haze, rising like a sickle of blood in the heavens. Its crescent was noticeably fuller than it had been the previous night. She stared at it rigidly, clenched the staff, but did not cry out. When she had tasted all its wrong, she said tonelessly, "There is no time," and turned her face away. But when morning came, she once more took charge of their pace. Under the pall of the despoiled moon, she seemed to have reached a resolution, and now she drove herself forward as if she were spurred by some self-curse or flagellation which rejected through naked determination the logic of defeat. She seemed to believe that she had lost everything for herself and for the land, yet the way she walked showed that pain could be as sharp a goad as any. Again, Covenant found himself hurrying as hard as he could to keep up with her fierce back. He accepted her pace in the name of his complex dread. He did not want to be caught by the forces that could attack wraiths and render moons incarnadine. But he was scrupulous about his VSE and other self-protections. If he could have found a blade other than his penknife, he would have shaved with it. They spent that day, part of the night, and the morning of the next day stumbling forward on the verge of a run. Covenant sustained their rate as best he could, but long days and restless nights had drained his stamina, made his stride ragged and his muscles irresilient. He came to lean more and more on his staff, unable to keep his balance without it. And even with it, he might have fallen if he had been pursuing such a pace in some other region. But the keen essence of Andalane supported him. Healthy air salved his lungs. Thick grass cushioned his sore joints. Gilden shaded him. Treasure berries burst with energy in his mouth. And at last, near noon on the sixth day, he and Atiyaran staggered over the crest of a hill and saw at the bottom of the slope beyond them the Soul's Ease River. Blue under the azure sky, it meandered broad, quiet and slow, almost directly eastward across their path, like a demarcation or boundary of achievement. As it turned and ran among the hills, it had a glitter of youth, a sparkle of contained exuberance which could burst into laughter the moment it was tickled by any shoals. And its water was as clean, clear, and fresh as an offer of baptism. At the sight of it, Covenant felt a rushing desire to plunge in, as if the stream had the power to wash away his mortality. But he was distracted from it almost immediately. Some distance away to the west, and moving upstream in the center of the river, was a boat, like a skiff, with a tall figure in the stern. The instant she saw it, Atiyaran cried out sharply, waved her arms, then began pelting down the slope, calling with a frantic edge to her voice, "Hail! Help! Come back! Come back!" Covenant followed less urgently. His gaze was fixed on the boat. With a swing of its prow, it turned in their direction. Atiyaran threw her arms into the air again, gave one more call, then dropped to the ground. When Covenant reached her, she was sitting with her knees clasped to her chest, and her lips trembled as if her face were about to break. She stared feverishly at the approaching boat. As it drew nearer, Covenant began to see with growing surprise just how tall the steering figure was. Before the boat was within 100 feet of them, he was sure that the steersman was twice his own height, and he could see no means of propulsion. The craft appeared to be nothing more than an enormous rowboat, but there were no oarlocks, no oars, no poles. He gaped widely at the boat as it glided closer. When it was within 30 feet of them, Atyaran thrust herself to her feet and called out, "Hail, Rock Brother! The Giants of Sea Reach are another name for friendship. Help us!" The boat kept gliding toward the bank, but its steersman did not speak, and shortly Atyaran added in a whisper that only Covenant could hear, "I beg you." The giant kept his silence as he approached. For the last distance, he swung the tiller over so that the boat's prow aimed squarely at the riverbank. Then, just before the craft struck, he drove his weight down in the stern. The prow lifted out of the water and grounded itself securely a few yards from Atyaran and Covenant. In a moment, the giant stood before them on the grass, offering them the salute of welcome. Covenant shook his head in wonder. He felt that it was impossible for anyone to be so big. The giant was at least 12 feet tall. But the rocky concreteness of the giant's presence contradicted him. The giant struck his perceptions as tangibly as stumbling on rough stone. Even for a being 12 feet tall, he appeared gnarled with muscles, like an oak come to life. He was dressed in a heavy leather jerkin and leggings and carried no weapons. A short beard, as stiff as iron, jutted from his face, and his eyes were small, deep-set and enthusiastic. From under his brows, massed over his sockets like the wall of a fortress, his glances flashed piercingly, like gleams from his cavernous thoughts. Yet, in spite of his imposing appearance, he gave an impression of incongruous geniality, of immense good humor. "Hail, Rock Sister," he said in a soft, bubbling tenor voice which sounded too light and gentle to come from his bemuscled throat. "What is your need? My help is willing, but I am a legate, and my embassy brooks little delay." Covenant expected Atyaran to blurt out her plea. The hesitation with which she met the giant's offer disturbed him. For a long moment, she gnawed her lips as if she were chewing over her rebellious flesh, searching for an utterance which would give direction, one way or another, to a choice she hated. Then, with her eyes downcast as if in shame, she murmured uncertainly, "Where do you go?" At her question, the giant's eyes flashed, and his voice bubbled like a spring of water from a rock as he said, "My destination? Who is wise enough to know his own goal? But I am bound for—" No, that name is too long a story for such a time as this. "I go to Lord's Keep, as you humans call it." Still hesitating, Atyaran asked, "What is your name?" "That is another long story," the giant returned and repeated, "What is your need?" But Atyaran insisted dully, "Your name." Again a gleam sprang from under the giant's massive brows. "There is power in names. I do not wish to be invoked by any but friends." "Your name," Atyaran groaned. For an instant, the giant paused, indecisive. Then he said, "Very well. Though my embassy is not a light one, I will answer for the sake of the loyalty between my people and yours. To speak shortly, I am called Saltheart Foam Follower." Abruptly, some resistance, some hatred of her decision, crumbled in Atyaran as if it had been defeated at last by the giant's trust. She raised her head, showing Covenant and Foam Follower the crushed landscape behind her eyes. With grave deliberation, she gave the salute of welcome. "Let it be so. Saltheart Foam Follower, Rock Brother and Giant's Legate, I charge you by the power of your name and by the great keep of faith which was made between Damalon, Giant Friend, and your people, to take this man, Thomas Covenant, unbeliever and stranger to the land, in safety to the Council of Lords. He bears messages to the Council from Kevin's Watch,
Ward him well, Rock Brother. I can go no farther. What?
Covenant gaped. In his surprise, he almost protested aloud, and give up your revenge? But he held himself still with his thoughts reeling and waited for her to take a stance he could comprehend.
You are too quick to call on such bold names, the giant said softly. I would have accepted your charge without them, but I urge you to join us. There are rare healings at Lord's Keep. Will you not come? Those who await you would not begrudge such a sojourn, not if they could see you as I do now.
Bitterness twisted Atiaran's lips.
Have you seen the new moon? That comes of the last healing I looked for.
As she went on, her voice grew gray with self-despite.
It is a futile charge I give you. I have already caused it to fail. There has been murder in all my choices since I became this man's guide. Such murder.
She choked on the bile of what she had seen and had to swallow violently before she could continue.
Because my path took us too close to Mount Thunder. You passed around that place. You must have seen the evil working there.
Distantly, the giant said,
I saw. We went into the knowledge of that wrong, rather than make our way across the center plains. And now it is too late for anyone. The Grey Slayer has returned. I chose that path because I desired healing for myself. What will happen to the lords if I ask them to help me now?
And give up your revenge? Covenant wondered. He could not comprehend. He turned completely toward her and studied her face, trying to see her health, her spirit. She looked as if she were in the grip of a ravaging illness. Her mien had thinned and sharpened. Her spacious eyes were shadowed, veiled in darkness. Her lips were drained of blood. And vertically down the center of her forehead lay a deep line like a rift in her skull, the tool work of unblinkable despair. Etched there was the vastness of the personal hurt which she contained by sheer force of will, and the damage she did herself by containing it. At last Covenant saw clearly the moral struggle that wasted her, the triple conflict between her abhorrence of him, her fear for the land, and her dismay at her own weakness, a struggle whose expense exhausted her resources, reduced her to penury. The sight shamed his heart, made him drop his gaze. Without thinking, he reached toward her and said in a voice full of self-contradicting pleas, "Don't give up."
"Give up," she gasped in virulence, backing away from him. "If I gave up, I would stab you where you stand."
Suddenly, she thrust a hand into her robe and snatched out a stone knife like the one Covenant had lost. Brandishing it, she spat,
"Since the celebration, since you permitted wraiths to die, this blade has cried out for your blood. Other crimes I could set aside. I speak for my own. But that, to countenance such desecration."
She hurled the knife savagely to the ground so that it stuck hilt deep in the turf by Covenant's feet.
"Behold," she cried,
and in that instant her voice became abruptly gelid, calm.
"I wound the earth instead of you. It is fitting. I have done little else since you entered the land. Now hear my last word, unbeliever. I let you go because these decisions surpass me. Delivering children in the stone down does not fit me for such choices. But I will not intrude my desires on the one hope of the land, barren as that hope is.
Remember that I have withheld my hand. I have kept my oath. Have you? He asked, moved by a complex impulse of sympathy and nameless ire. She pointed a trembling finger at her knife. I have not harmed you. I have brought you here. You've hurt yourself. That is my oath, she breathed stiffly. Now, farewell. When you have returned in safety to your own world, remember what evil is. He wanted to protest, argue, but her emotion mastered him, and he held himself silent before the force of her resolve. Under the duress of her eyes, he bent and drew her knife out of the grass. It came up easily. He half expected to see blood ooze from the slash it had made in the turf, but the thick grass closed over the cut, hiding it as completely as an absolution. Unconsciously, he tested the blade with his thumb, felt its acuteness. When he looked up again, he saw that Atiyaran was climbing up the hill and away, moving with the unequal stride of a cripple. This isn't right, he shouted at her back. Have mercy. Pity. But his tongue felt too thick with the pain of her renunciation. He could not speak. At least forgive yourself. The tightness of his face gave him a nasty impression that he was grinning. Atiyaran, he groaned. Why are we so unable? Into his aching, the giant's voice came gently. Shall we go? Dumbly, Covenant nodded. He tore his eyes from Atiyaran's toiling back and shoved her knife under his belt. Saltheart Foam Follower motioned for him to climb into the boat. When Covenant had vaulted over the gunwale and taken a seat on a thwart in the prow, the only seat in the 30-foot craft small enough for him, the giant stepped aboard, pushing off from the bank at the same time. Then he went to the broad, shallow stern. Standing there, he grasped the tiller. A surge of power flowed through the keel. He swung his craft away from the riverbank into midstream, and shortly it was moving westward among the hills. As soon as he had taken his seat, Covenant had turned with failure in his throat to watch Atiyaran's progress up the hillside. But the surge of power which moved the boat gave it a brisk pace as fast as running, and in moments distance had reduced her to a brown mite in the lush, oblivious green of Andalane. With a harsh effort, he forced his eyes to let her go, compelled himself to look instead for the source of the boat's power. But he could locate no power source. The boat ran smoothly up against the current as if it were being towed by fish. It had no propulsion that he could discern. Yet his nerves were sensitive to the energy flowing through the keel. Dimly he asked, "What makes this thing move? I don't see any engine." Foam Follower stood in the stern, facing upstream, with the high tiller under his left arm and his right held up to the river breezes. And he was chanting something, some plain song in a language Covenant could not understand. A song with a wave-breaking, salty timbre like the taste of the sea. For a moment after Covenant's question, he kept up his rolling chant. But soon its language changed, and Covenant heard him sing, "Stone and sea are deep in life, two unalterable symbols of the world. Permanence at rest and permanence in motion, participants in the power that remains." Then Foam Follower stopped and looked down at Covenant with humor sparkling under his unbreachable brows. "A stranger to the land," he said. "Did that woman teach you nothing?" Covenant stiffened in his seat. The giant's tone seemed to demean Atiyaran, denigrate the cost she had borne. His bland, impregnable forehead and humorous glance appeared impervious to sympathy. But her pain was vivid to Covenant. She had been dispossessed of so much normal human love and warmth. In a voice rigid with anger, he retorted, "She is Atiyaran, trailmate of Mithil Stonedown, and she did better than teach me. She brought me safely past Ravers, murdered Wayanhim, a bloody moon, Irviles. Could you have done it?" Foam Follower did not reply, but a grin spread gaily over his face, raising the end of his beard like a mock salute. "By hell," Covenant flared. "Do you think I'm lying? I wouldn't condescend to lie to you." At that, the giant's humor burst into high, head-back, bubbling laughter. Covenant watched, stifling with rage, while Foam Follower laughed. Briefly, he bore the affront. Then he jumped from his seat and raised his staff to strike the giant. Foam Follower stopped him with a placating gesture. "Softly, unbeliever," he said. "Will you feel taller if I sit down?" "Hell and blood," Covenant howled. Swinging his arms savagely, he struck the floorboards with the Irvile blackened end of his staff. The boat pitched as if his blow had sent the river into convulsions. Staggering, he clutched a thwart to save himself from being thrown overboard. In a moment, the spasm passed, leaving the sun-glittered stream as calm as before. But he remained gripping the thwart for several long heartbeats while his nerves jangled and his ring throbbed heavily. "Covenant," he snarled to steady himself. "You would be ridiculous if you weren't so ridiculous." He drew himself erect and stood with his feet braced until he had a stranglehold on his emotions. Then he bent his gaze toward Foam Follower, probed the giant's aura. But he could perceive no ill. Foam Follower seemed as hale as native granite. "Ridiculous," Covenant repeated. "She deserves respect."
"Ah, forgive me," said the giant.
With a twist, he lowered the tiller so that he could hold it under his arm in a sitting position.
"I meant no disrespect. Your loyalty relieves me. And I know how to value what she has achieved."
He seated himself in the stern and leaned back against the tiller so that his eyes were only a foot above Covenant's.
"Yes, and how to grieve for her as well. There are none in the land, not men or giants or Ranihin, who would bear you to Lord's Keep faster than I will."
Then his smile returned.
"But you, Thomas Covenant, unbeliever and stranger in the land, you burn yourself too freely. I laughed when I saw you because you seemed like a rooster threatening one of the run-in. You waste yourself, Thomas Covenant."
Covenant took a double grip on his anger and said quietly, "Is that a fact?" "You judge too quickly, giant." Another fountain of laughter bubbled out of Foam Follower's chest.
"Bravely said. Here is a new thing in the land. A man accusing a giant of haste. Well, you are right. But did you not know that men consider us a..."
He laughed again.
"A deliberate people. I was chosen as legate because short human names, which bereave their bearers of so much history and power and meaning, are easier for me than for most of my people. But now it appears that they are too easy."
Once more he threw back his head and let out a stream of deep gaiety. Covenant glared at the giant as if all this humor were incomprehensible to him. Then with an effort he pulled himself away, dropped his staff into the bottom of the boat, and sat down on the thwart facing forward, into the west and the afternoon sun. Foam Follower's laughter had a contagious sound, a coloration of uncomplicated joy, but he resisted it. He could not afford to be the victim of any more seductions. Already he had lost more of himself than he could hope to regain. "Nerves don't regenerate. He told the words as if they were a private litany, icons of his embattled self. Giants don't exist. I know the difference. Keep moving. Survive. He chewed his lips as if that pain could help him keep his balance, keep his rage under command. At his back, Salt Heart Foam Follower softly began to chant again. His song rolled through its channel like a long inlet to the sea, rising and falling like a condensation of the tides, and the winds of distance blew through the archaic words. At intervals, they returned to their refrain, "Stone and sea are deep in life," then voyaged away again. The sound of long sojourning reminded Covenant of his fatigue, and he slumped in the prow to rest. Foam Follower's question caught him wandering. "Are you a storyteller, Thomas Covenant?" Absently, he replied, "I was once." "And you gave it up?" "Ah, that is as sad a tale in three words as any you might have told me. But a life without a tale is like a sea without salt. How do you live?" Covenant folded his arms across the gunwales and rested his chin on them. As the boat moved, Andalane opened constantly in front of him like a bud. But he ignored it, concentrated instead on the plaint of water past the prow. Unconsciously, he clenched his fist over his ring. "I live." "Another," Foam Follower returned. "In two words, a story sadder than the first. Say no more. With one word, you will make me weep." If the giant intended any umbrage, Covenant could not hear it. Foam Follower sounded half teasing, half sympathetic. Covenant shrugged his shoulders and remained silent. In a moment, the giant went on, "Well, this is a bad pass for me. Our journeying will not be easy, and I had hoped that you could lighten the leagues with a story. But no matter. I judge that you will tell no happy tales in any case. Ravers, Wayanhim, and Andalanian wraiths slain. Well, some of this does not surprise me. Our old ones have often guessed that Soul Crusher would not die as easily as poor Kevin hoped. Stone and sea, all that desecration, ravage and rapine for a false hope. But we have a saying, and it comforts our children, few as they are, when they weep for the nation, the homes and company of our people, which we lost. We say joy is in the ears that hear, not in the mouth that speaks. The world has few stories glad in themselves, and we must have gay ears to defy despite. Praise the Creator. Old Lord Damelon, giant friend, knew the value of a good laugh. When we reached the land, we were too grieved to fight for the right to live." "A good laugh," Covenant sighed morosely. "Did I do a whole life's laughing in that little time?" "You humans are an impatient lot, Thomas Covenant. Do you think that I ramble? Not a bit. I have come hastening to the point. Since you have given up the telling of stories, and since it appears that neither of us is happy enough to withstand the recital of your adventures, why, I must do the telling myself. There is strength in stories. Heart rebirth and thew binding, and even giants need strength when they face such tasks as mine." He paused, and Covenant, not wishing him to stop, the giant's voice seemed to weave the rush of water past the boat into a soothing tapestry, said into the silence, "Tell." "Ah," Foam Follower responded, "that was not so bad. You recover despite yourself, Thomas Covenant. Now, then, gladden your ears and listen gaily, for I am no purveyor of sorrows, though in times of action we do not wince from facts. If you asked me to resail your path here, I would require every detail of your journey before I took 3 steps into the hills. Resailing is perilous, and too often return is impossible. The path is lost, or the traveler changed, beyond hope of recovery.